All right. Hello and welcome to the Mobility Podcast. My name is Greg Rogers with Securing America's Future Energy. And we are once again at the Automated Vehicle Symposium in Orlando, Florida. And I'm very thrilled to be with Chris Urmson, the CEO and co-founder of Aurora. Chris, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Yeah, and so Chris is one of the legacy figures in the AV industry, if you're not familiar. And but Chris, I'll let you jump in and introduce yourself and sort of how you got in the industry and how this all started.
Yeah, well, it's pretty incredible to be here at the conference. I guess I've been working in this space for about the last 15 years, maybe a little longer. And it's, back then it was the DARPA Grand Challenges and building robots to drive across the military to ultimately serve in the supply chain. And then over the last decade, it's focused more on how do we make vehicles serve the public and make our roadways safer, make transportation more accessible and less expensive. And it's neat to see both, this conference, which, I went to the predecessor for, where there was, a few dozen people to, I think, over 1,500 people are, here today. And the investment in this space as it's ramped from, rubbing together a few nickels when we started out to an incredible enthusiasm throughout the transportation sector. Mm-hmm. So exciting to see.
Absolutely. And so you were at Carnegie Mellon when the DARPA Grand Challenges were going on, and then went to Google and helped start the Google Self-Driving Car Project, and then started Aurora afterwards. So could you tell me a little bit about why you made the choice to go from Google into starting your own thing and looking at doing this yourself?
Sure. So I had 7.5 just amazing years at Google. It was really an incredible opportunity to be there, help build the technology, help build the team, and really I think Google's investment in the space was one of the big things that spawned this whole industry and this space. It allowed to demonstrate the potential for this. It allowed us to demonstrate the potential for this technology. But after 7.5 years, that it's a long time to be anywhere. Mm-hmm. And it was time to kind of get out of the way and allow that project to carry on and go where it was going. And so I stepped away and spent a few months trying to figure out what was next for me. And I was fortunate to have a variety of different opportunities. But at the end of the day, realized that there was an incredible opportunity to build something new to help accelerate this technology, and was very fortunate to find a couple of great co-founders who were deeply experienced. Drew Bagnell, our CTO and co-founder, has been one of the luminaries in machine learning applied to motion planning for robotics, and then Sterling Anderson, an MIT PhD, spent some time at McKinsey, and then helped launch Model X and Autopilot at Tesla. And so, two great people to help build something with, and they're both just excellent human beings as well. And then from there, over the last 2.5 years, we've been building the company. We're now almost 300 people, and we have a great set of investors supporting us who share the vision for delivering the benefits of self-driving technology, safely, quickly, and broadly, as we say.
Mm-hmm. I love that, and I want to dig into your presentation this morning because we're talking about sort of the evolution of the industry and then some of the firsts that you got to see. One of them was the first collision between two AVs. This was during the DARPA Grand Challenge, or the Urban Challenge, right?
Yeah, it was in the Urban Challenge. And so that competition was about building vehicles that could understand basic traffic rules and interact with other vehicles on the roadway. So the Grand Challenge before that was really, can you make something reliably drive 150 miles across the desert? And the second, the Urban Challenge, which was actually the third event, was this drive around an airbase for 60 miles, go in between a set of waypoints, and make sure that you stop when you're supposed to at stop signs, and yield to other traffic and take your turn appropriately and stay on your side of the road. And during that competition, they had, I think there was 15 robot vehicles, and they had another 50 stunt drivers out creating traffic. And it was really impressive to see how well those vehicles drove in that environment. That if you kind of squinted and didn't notice all of the sensors and other stuff kind of hanging off the outside of these vehicles, to see them interact was impressive. And yeah, that was the first time we had a robot on robot self-driving car crash. And the event that occurred was there was a traffic circle that the vehicles had to travel through. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reason, Cornell went into that traffic circle and stopped and just sat there for a while. And the MIT vehicle came up upon it and saw it, made a maneuver to kind of swerve out around it and then, drive in front of it. And partway through that maneuver, the Cornell vehicle drove into its quarter panel, mm-hmm. Started to move again. And I think it's one, it's just kind of a fun anecdote from, back in the day. But the other thing that's interesting is it really represents one of the core challenges we face today, which is anticipating the behavior of other drivers on the road. Mm-hmm. In this case, they were both automated vehicles. But as our vehicles are out testing each day, most of the other drivers do what you'd expect. They continue down the lane in front of them, but every once in a while, somebody misses their exit and has to make a sudden maneuver or aggressively pulls in front. And anticipating those behaviors and reacting gracefully to them is really what makes this hard.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And one of the other firsts I thought was interesting was the first time that an AV was pulled over. So we're fast forwarding sort of to when you were with the Google self-driving car project. Yeah. I think there was an interesting lesson that you sort of seemed to pull out of that.
Yeah, no, that was, we had been at this point working for, 6 years, and we had the prototype vehicles, these little cute koala-shaped cars out on the road, and they were limited to driving at 25 miles per hour. Mm-hmm. And one day, we find one of our vehicles has been pulled over and somebody, BuzzFeed or somebody got a hold of a photo of a police motorcycle having pulled over the vehicle and asking questions to the driver. And to the best of our knowledge, that's the first time a self-driving car had been pulled over by the police. And at the time, the explanation was that it was holding up the flow of traffic. Mm-hmm. Which I didn't know you could get pulled over before, but apparently you can. But we went back and looked at the tape, because we had all the data, and the car wasn't really holding up traffic. There wasn't traffic there to be held up. But the officer was very polite and, asked a lot of questions. And so really, I think what we learned from this was really he was just curious, right, about what was going on. And I think the lesson for all of us is that those of us who work in this industry get to work on something that captures a lot of people's imagination, and they have a lot of questions. And it's part of our responsibility to share and to help people understand what we're doing, the opportunities, the risks, and why many of us see this as just a critical next step for transportation.
Mm-hmm. And, transparency is huge, obviously, as you touched on. And this morning you were discussing the importance of reducing unnecessary risk, yeah, and in making sure that the public can trust in AV developers. How can you convince the public that your vehicles are safe? What's the key here?
Yeah, unfortunately, there's no silver bullet, right? There isn't just show them this and call it done. I think, at Aurora, one of our core values is operating with integrity. That's actually the first one on our list. And I think that is a critical part of convincing the public, convincing regulators, convincing our partners that we're going to operate in the right way. And that's not something where we can have the marketing team put together a video and sell it. It's that every day our engineers need to understand, our operators need to understand, people in our legal team and finance and marketing communications understand that integrity is fundamental to building a business, and building a business is going to be here for the long term, and a technology that they can trust. And then from that integrity, we put in place the policies and procedures and mindsets that lead us to have a culture of safety internally. And this is allowing people to feel confident that if they see something, they should say something. That mm-hmm. we encourage people, if they don't feel comfortable, it's okay to in our, you know, ground the fleet, for example, to pull our test vehicles back off the road and take a breath and analyze, you know, or investigate whatever the concern was. And some of the time it's that person didn't actually understand everything, but we'd much rather have them err on the side of caution and take just a, you know, take a little bit of time out of everyone's day to understand this and then go back safely. Because many times they flag something that is important and that, you know, requires remedial action. And so having that underlying culture, I think, is super important. And then from there, we have to build the safety case, as one of the speakers talked about this morning, explaining why we have confidence in the system. And it isn't just, you know, we drove X miles. It's we developed the technology in this way. We evaluated it in this way. We looked at these risks. We looked at these hazards, and we found ways to mitigate or reduce the risk from them to a point where it's not unreasonable. And it's really important that we don't talk about perfection, because the only safe car today is the one wrapped in bubble wrap in your garage. But it turns out that's not useful.
Right.
Anytime when we're moving at speed on the roadway, there's some risk. And what we need to do when we're building automated vehicle technology is deliver that technology in a way where we're not increasing that risk. And over, you know, certainly over time, we're decreasing that risk and making the roads dramatically safer.
Mm-hmm. And I just want to highlight this. So anyone at Aurora can call for grounding the fleet. Is that right?
That's correct. It doesn't matter whether they're, you know, an executive assistant or an engineer or one of our vehicle operators. And you know, we do this with some regularity. And I think the biggest part of this is having a culture where people understand that that's good and healthy, and that it's okay to take a step or take a breath, take a step back, and understand the concern, and that, you know, we put that first and foremost ahead of, you know, our corporate objectives, our technology development objectives, and everything else. It's making sure that we're developing something that is safe and developing it in a way that is safe.
And on that note, the U.S. Department of Transportation has asked autonomous vehicle developers to submit their voluntary safety self-assessments, which we've talked on the podcast before about VSSAs. And Aurora submitted theirs, and I'd be interested to hear about what you think about, what you think needs to be done in sort of working with the federal government, what your experience has been there. And if further action should be taken by the federal government to make sure these vehicles are safe.
Yeah. So first and foremost, the folks who work in our federal government are there out of a feeling of out of a need to serve the country, and that's what I've seen in all of my engagements with them, is that these are people that, you know, in general are very competent. They could go be working in the private sector and likely making more money. But, you know, they've decided to go and work for a federal agency to serve the public. And I think when we engage with them, when I've engaged with them over the last decade, you know, making sure you have that mindset of we're on the same team, we all are working towards the same objective, which is improving transportation and doing that in a way that's safe, it makes the conversations, you know, constructive and really, really meaningful. You know, I've been engaging with them roughly over the last decade, and I've always found them to be very thoughtful. They're not out in the field developing the technology, and so I see it as part of our responsibility as folks who are to help keep them up to date with where the technology is, what we see as the opportunities, being honest with them, what we see as are the risks, because that allows them to play their role, which is that of regulator, and that of helping keep the legislative and executive bodies of our government informed. Mm-hmm. And I think that is really the biggest thing we can be doing as an industry, and that they can be doing is having a perspective, having that perspective supported by data, so that when the inevitable bad events occur, they aren't trapped into some kind of knee-jerk reaction to
right.
it. And allowing them to have enough data that when a congressperson comes to them or an executive branch person comes to them with a proposal, they can have an informed opinion and weigh the benefits of the technology, the risks, and, you know, societal, or, you know, our the will of the public to get the right outcome.
And we're sort of this interesting point too with the federal regulations, because you know when Google was building the Firefly vehicle, the cute little koala looking car, there was some issue with getting exemptions for being able to put these vehicles on the road. Do you see the ability for NHTSA to be able to make some of these changes and be flexible and allow, maybe of course the koala would end up, the Firefly ended up just being sort of forgotten by Google. They've sort of moved on and went another direction. But when we're talking about sort of these standard regulations, FMVSS, there are a lot of things that sort of stop you from using novel designs in vehicles. How do you see NHTSA sort of being able to keep up and sort of move towards allowing these different kind of vehicle designs?
Yeah, well, I think the first thing is that they've actually been doing a what I think has been a good job and taking a reasonable approach, which is putting guidelines in place that help us have guardrails on behavior and how they expect us to share information with them and the public. Mm-hmm. Because while I'm a very adamant supporter and deep believer in the benefits of this technology, it still doesn't really exist, mm-hmm. right? You know, it's not in commerce, and we haven't really got to a point where we understand where the right place is to regulate. Mm-hmm. The exemptions are an interesting space. You know, for those of those, you know, maybe those of your listeners who don't know exactly what that means, is that you know, building a car, you have to comply with the Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standard, and you know, individual companies certify that the product they're putting on the road, you know, meets those standards. And it's things from, you know, the tension of your seatbelt at different occasions to the fact that the turn signals are disabled by mechanical rotation of the steering wheel. Mm-hmm. And these have been built up over decades of describing what, you know, what we think is best practices for safety of these vehicles. Now, of course, as we move to automated vehicles, some of the things that were relevant and best practice when a person is behind the wheel and driving are less relevant now. But the vast majority of FMVSS actually, is the right thing to be complying with still. It's just these, you know, honestly, it's the places where they weren't quite as crisp. In general, FMVSS is describing what the outcome should be, mm-hmm. less about exactly how it should be done. And there's a few places where you know, that kind of missed. And, you know, the one that I think about most concretely is, turns out in your car, there's no obligation for there to be a steering wheel, other than the fact that it's required because the turn signal has to be deactivated by a mechanical rotation of the steering column. Mm-hmm. That's the only reason why there's actually a requirement for a steering wheel in a car, according to FMVSS. And so I think there, over time, what the exemptions can do is, as an auto manufacturer, you can say that we're only going to produce a limited number of vehicles, less than this exemption number, and because we believe, you know, here's our argument why this system is as safe or safer than what would be required by law, mm-hmm. Allow us to produce those vehicles fundamentally so that we can get in-use or field evidence that our safety claims are accurate, in the hope that over time there will be regulatory relief in changes to the FMVSS. Mm-hmm. And so there is some room for where I can imagine exemptions being useful for the next few years, but I don't think it's actually fundamental to the deployment of the technology.
And so GM Cruise submitted an exemption request for a vehicle without steering wheels, brake pedals, etc. Does Aurora have plans to put something out like that in the near future?
So at Aurora, our model is to work with our partners in the automotive industry and in the transportation industry more broadly. And so we don't design vehicles. Mm-hmm. So we'll let our partners talk about what their vehicle plans are. But if the question is more, do I think that ultimately we'll be able to deliver vehicles that can operate without a steering wheel, brake belts? Yes, I do.
That's right? Kind of the goal, right?
Yeah, that's certainly where we're shooting towards.
So I'd like to move into sort of state and local policy. You guys have always sort of been active in Pittsburgh. It's sort of in your blood. And you've been working with Pennsylvania DOT and our friend Secretary Richards over there, who we spoke with recently, talked a lot about the need for communication between AV companies and the public sector.
Yeah.
I'd like to hear a little bit more about how you're thinking about working with not just the federal government, but also the state government, maybe city governments as well.
Yeah, well, and it's kind of out of necessity. Mm-hmm. You know, these folks are the elected officials that are in place to help, regulate at different scales. How vehicles are used on the roadway. And so the federal government regulates the safety of the vehicle itself. The state government regulates the safety of the driver and the rules around who can drive and operate vehicles. And then the city actually kind of governs the use of the streets within them in general and curb rights and whatnot. And so and all of them represent the people that this technology is ultimately going to serve. And so we feel a responsibility to communicate with them and help them understand, bring to them our vision for what the technology can mean, listen to them about their concerns and their vision for it, and, ultimately help deliver a better product and a better technology into the world that, delivers on our mission.
Mm-hmm. And so you were the first AV company, I believe, to receive authorization to test in Pennsylvania, right?
We were. We're pretty proud of that because we talk about having these conversations, and it's a nice proof point that we actually meant it. Because while it's authorization, it's a voluntary authorization, and nothing really changed the day before or the day after we had that authorization. But we saw it as a demonstration of our commitment to have those conversations and put the effort into the relationship that we think it warrants.
Mm-hmm. And so the other important part about sort of reaching the point of deployment is, of course, making sure the public is comfortable.
Yeah.
And Aurora was also a founding member of the Partnership for Automated Vehicle Education, or PAVE. What are your thoughts on how PAVE can really help to, advance the dialogue around AVs and help to educate the public?
Well, I think the biggest opportunity is helping the public understand what we mean by automated vehicles, because over the last 5-7 years, self-driving vehicle, automated vehicle technology, it's become an umbrella term that can refer from everything from a low-level driver assistance feature to a car where you can have a nap in it and drives you between cities and, mm-hmm. and everything in between.
And we only have one side of those, which is just sort of the driver assistance, right?
Yeah, that's the only thing you can.
The other side is already there.
That's the only thing you can actually buy today. Mm-hmm. As you say, there's kind of confusion in the public. I think there was a survey that I read that people thought they could buy a self-driving car today, and that's we're clearly not there yet. And so I think PAVE, is explicitly not an advocacy group. It's an education group, and the idea is to help the public understand where we are, what the technology means, what the differences in the technology are, to help reduce confusion, because I think a lot of times confusion is one of the things that can lead to a lack of trust. In general, if you fail to set expectations and then miss them, that's where people get upset, confused, and worried. And so I think it's a really important initiative for us as a community.
Mm-hmm. This goes back to the sort of the policeman example, right? You have to make sure that the people that are around when you're testing, they already know what the vehicles are. And that's, I think that's absolutely crucial, especially on sort of the law enforcement end as well. I'd like to, you have some exciting announcements of investments recently, Hyundai and Kia. Also acquired Blackmore LiDAR recently. There's a lot of growth happening, and so how do you see sort of these helping Aurora to get closer and closer to eventual deployment?
Yeah, it's been a busy 6-9 months for us. We're really, the company is really mission driven. I know many companies say that, but for us, I think if you asked any one of our employees, they get what we're about, and that's delivering the benefits of automated vehicle technology safely, quickly, and broadly. And each one of these things is, whether it's the investment from, leading venture capital firms and private equity through Sequoia or Amazon or T. Rowe Price, right? Those are folks who have a long vision for this technology. A long-term vision for the technology. They understand how complicated it is. They've had the opportunity to invest in anything, and they've chosen to place their bets with us, and you know, we're very proud of that. But it's, I think it's a really strong signal to our employees and to future employees that this is the place to go solve this. To having a partner, an automotive partner like Hyundai Kia with us is again tremendous. They're one of these companies that if you look at their trajectory over the last decade, it's, you know, it's straight up, on any dimension you want to think about, whether it's quality or safety or volume. So that's tremendous. And then with the acquisition of the LiDAR company Blackmore, there we just see kindred spirits, that these are folks who are developing the next generation of LiDAR technology. They've been at it for a decade plus. Mm-hmm. When we hear from other LiDAR companies that they're trying this, that, or the other thing, our friends at Blackmore tried that and it didn't work, tried this other thing and it didn't work, tried the third thing and it didn't work, and are now on to the sixth or seventh thing, and are deeply knowledgeable in that space. And what we think is particularly compelling about the technology is that it's this frequency-modulated approach to LiDAR rather than pulsed LiDAR, and that means that it can be lower power while still penetrating, you know, more obscurance in the air, and it allows us to measure the velocity directly of the thing that it's measuring. And so when we couple that next-generation capability with some of the next-generation things we're doing on the software side of the house to understand the world around the vehicle, we think that enables us to leapfrog some of the folks who've been at this for a bit longer.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting because your focus is on sort of building the driver, building the actual software. Why acquire a LiDAR company? What's actually working on the hardware? What's the appeal there?
Well, when we say building the driver, mm-hmm. that really means the ability to drive the vehicle. And so that's the combination of the hardware, the software, and the data services that enable it. So so LiDAR, we think, is one of the key technologies. We use computer vision off of cameras. We use radar. But we also think LiDAR is super important. So we need to have that developed to the specification we think is necessary to make this ultimately work. On the software side, obviously, it's taking the data that comes back from those sensors, fusing it together, figuring out what's happening in the world this moment, what's about to happen to the world over the next few seconds, mm-hmm. And then motion planning to figure out how do we move safely through that, and then we hand that off to the vehicle to execute the trajectory that we're going to drive. Mm-hmm. And then the data services part of this is things like the map data product that gives the vehicle a heads up as to what to expect in the world, and engineering that in a way that we can maintain it and update it, you know, with confidence.
Mm-hmm. So it sort of makes sense because when you're building the driver, you obviously have to have the eyes and the ears, and so it's a big part for you, of course.
Absolutely.
So you also received investments from Amazon. I don't want to ask you to put words in their mouth, but let's say that Amazon's looking at, say, autonomous trucking. What would the difficulty be of taking your technology, mostly focused on sort of passenger vehicles, and put it into, say, a truck? I mean, how much does this differ in terms of technology and the software and hardware needs you would have?
Yeah, so we go back to the philosophy that we're building a driver, and that driver can operate a compact car or a minivan or a box truck or a Class 8 truck.
It's the world's best driver.
It's the world's best driver, right? And it can span those. And this is why we do think it's important to have consistent sensors, consistent software, because the hard part, the crux of the problem, is that understanding of the world around the vehicle and understanding how you want to move through it. There's clearly engineering work in making a big truck follow a trajectory that's different than the engineering work to make a compact car follow a trajectory. And, you know, there's some additional parameters that are a bit different. There's more inertia, you know, obviously with a big truck, it's articulated. Mm-hmm. But those are kind of around the edge of this core capability. And so, you know, we've already integrated our technology onto, I think, 5 different platforms, and those range from compact car to a mid-sized car to even some work on a Class 8 truck.
Great. So I want to move over to, I think we're about to run out of time, but I'd like to touch on sort of deployment timelines. Sure. About 10 years ago, everyone was very optimistic. It seemed like, you know, AVs will all be in an AV in 2020. was sort of seemed to be the sense.
Well, I think 10 years ago, everyone thought we were crazy. Yeah. So I think that's, you know, I think you know, sentiment has swung, and you're right. There certainly was. It's all going to be solved by 2020. And I think what you're seeing is, one, some of the folks who are saying that didn't understand quite how hard the problem was. Some of us, myself included, were maybe a little more optimistic than, but we've learned a ton over the last 5 years. And from my perspective, my confidence that this technology will get deployed has only gone up. Mm-hmm. That as I've dug into it, and the teams that I've had the privilege of leading have dug into it, right? It's doable. It's hard. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't go after it. It's also incredibly important. People forget when we talk about safety for automated vehicle, that's super important, and we can't lose sight of that. But the status quo that we look at on the roads is not acceptable. The 40,000 Americans, 1.5 million people globally that die in traffic accidents every year, these are accidents that can be avoided, and this technology ultimately will drive those rates down dramatically. And that's that's an opportunity to relieve an awful lot of human suffering and emotional damage, but it also has a profound economic impact. In the U.S., the drag on the U.S. economy is something approaching $1 trillion mm-hmm. From traffic accidents. And so you imagine we're able to cut that out of the nation's GDP. That's incredible, right? The opportunity that unlocks. And so, I kind of lost what the question was. I'm sorry, but I think that within the next 5 years we're going to see this, and that I have confidence that it'll start at small scale, and then as we learn about the technology deployed in the field, and we learn about the economics of the business of that, and as we put in place the manufacturing infrastructure to be able to build these vehicles at scale, and then we'll see fairly rapid adoption mm-hmm. after that.
Do you feel like your sort of deployment timeline predictions have changed over the years?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I famously said that by the time my oldest son was 2016, he hopefully wouldn't have to drive. And, I feel not bad about that. Mm-hmm. If we lived in Phoenix and he were maybe a year younger, I think there's a good chance, if we lived in the right neighborhood, that he could have
do something. Spots
and he only wanted to go to certain spots. So, but, I think you have to have a vision mm-hmm. And you have to, set some, aggressive goals. Obviously, you have to put safety first, and we're seeing that. That certainly is a theme of the morning here at the conference. But without that, we don't make any progress.
Great, Chris. Thank you for joining me. If there's anything that we could share for our listeners, or if they want to follow you online, are you on Twitter, or can we see Aurora online?
Yeah, you can find Aurora at www.aurora.tech, mm-hmm. and I am technically on Twitter, but only post for the most rare and important things.
Great. And for our listeners, stay tuned throughout the week for more episodes of the Mobility Podcast. Also follow us online. I am at AV Greg R. The Mobility Podcast is at Mobility Podcast. And follow along with AVS at #AVS on Twitter. And of course, you can always find our episodes on our website, mobilitypodcast.com. Well, Chris, thank you again.
Thank you. Thanks. I appreciate it.